Incidentally, just to keep us all on the same page, as we say, and this does involve pages, the two-thirds mark for next week will fall almost exactly at the end of part three. So read through the end of book nine for next Tuesday. Okay. Now, we... We are still working. I'm still working on combining the reading lists. I just got one in today, so that has made it a little slow getting it. Actually, this afternoon, so it should be ready soon. I'm very enthusiastic about what I think this will be as an aid for you. So, yes, Angela.
So how much do these quizzes really count? Yeah, it just seems like it seems a pretty big mystery because so many of them are floating out there.
And yes, that's right. And I'm going to get those back to you. I'm just on the cusp of a breakthrough on this on this project. But yes,
Also, are you going to drop three of the grades?
Yes, we said we would drop three of them. Oh, so we generally assume that will probably include the Dead Souls quiz for most of them. Since then, there's been a remarkable improvement in a lot of in the average as a class, but yeah.
But our real energy should be in the essay. That's going to count for a lot more than all the quizzes,
yes.
Right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, the quizzes together are I forget exactly what we said, 10 or 15%, something
okay.
like that.
Oh, good.
So this is just a, you know, so don't contemplate any great life changes based on how you think you may have done on these quizzes. No, they're just to whip you through. You need some prodding probably to keep turning the pages. Although, again, I'm amazed at how well the Russian novelists wrote to get us to turn those pages quickly. It's amazing. So, yeah. Now, thinking about the upcoming paper. What I hope to do soon, I'd like to come either Thursday or next week with a schedule for you to all come in and talk to me personally about your ideas. So be thinking of a particular project that you'd like to be working on. Now, let me say also, if you're an undergraduate, I think I would like to say my strong preference is that you do a paper on not just one novel. Okay, I'd like to see a more general focus if you are an undergraduate writing this term. Okay. Not only do I think that makes it easier for you, actually, but I think I want to see that kind of synthesizing work that you're able to look at Dostoevsky's work in a broader context, a motif that runs through his work, or his development in a certain way, or an idea that runs through his fiction and so forth. Now, that's also a possible path for you graduate students, but it's also possible for you to really dwell on one particular novel and bore into that novel.
Mm-hmm. Two things. Are we allowed to compare? I know this is a Dostoevsky paper. Are we allowed to compare Dostoevsky to other novelists?
Yes, certainly.
Or are we allowed to use other Dostoevsky books not covered in this class?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep, those are both relevant. Although Kurt Vonnegut, probably not.
Not a good match.
Sorry.
I'm just kidding. Probably not a good match to compare to Kurt Vonnegut. I would prefer if you compare other novelists that you would really use the ones from our course.
Yes.
Right. But that's the main thing. What else? Now, in thinking about how to use outside reading sources, outside critical readings, secondary sources, right? And this is important, again, especially for undergraduates, but it's a general remark for everybody. Don't think that you have to try to focus on somebody who's written on your particular topic, because there may not have been anybody, or they may have been few and far between, or they may have been inept. I would like to see you be able to use secondary sources that are reliable in talking about Dostoevsky in a general way, and talking about the Russian novel in a general way. There are many, many general points that you can bring in to support your argument in your paper. Okay, and that's even without the very unadvisable beginning in which you begin as broad as could possibly be and then slowly narrow it down. I do think you ought to begin with a focus. Begin with your focus. Hit that first punch hard. Nonetheless, we want to know, how is Dostoevsky thought of? What do his critics think some of his major themes and major concerns? What do critics think about how he developed in a particular novel and so forth? How do we use the term polyphony? It might be handy and so forth. All these kinds of things can be used, and I would encourage that for you.
Okay.
So any other questions at this point about thinking about forming a notion from a vague cloud into a little bit more focused idea? Grace, did you?
Vague cloud being, could we use something like Dostoevsky's adaptation of kind of Cervantes, such as in The Idiot, and the use of the poem of Pushkin, or such as his...
Is that too focused?
Shakespeare and Miltonic influences in The Demons, how he takes carnivalism. Is that too focused? Definitely weighted on it.
Depends on how much you make of it.
If I were you, I would say make your real topic in that concern something thematic and intellectual, and then bring in the Cervantes reference or Milton reference or something. Okay? But don't make it just be about that relation. That's going to wear thin. You want to be asking a big question in your paper, and not just tracing. Not just being a scribe or a librarian who's tracing these connections.
So if you wrote about the holy fool, for example, you might well say, in what sense is Hamlet a holy fool and Quixote, and how do those come into play in Dostoevsky's novels, for example?
Right. That's good.
Hamlet, the holy fool.
Yes, uh-huh.
I just have one question. When we're quoting, would you like us to quote the text, in Russian and then provide a translation?
No.
Or would you, we can just go straight translation?
You speak Russian?
Well, no, but like when you're quoting usually for...
Let me just say, I don't require that.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So we, I think, in our introduction, really just got through book one. So we want to go on. We return then to Father Zosima in book two, at the beginning of book two, and my assumption was that we would try to make it all the way through the Grand Inquisitor today. But if we don't get there, I won't feel as bad. Not everyone made it that far themselves. Well, all right. So back to book two and the cell of Father Zosima, and that really is the first detail that it would be good to note and to begin with. In chapter 2 of book 2, the one titled The Old Buffoon, we do get a description of Father Zosima's cell, and it's interesting for a point of contrast because we've already seen the cell of an old monk in the Possessed, and you remember Father Tihon's cell, which has all these artworks and has not just that, but has fine furniture mixed with sticks, and has a great eclectic thing, but seems very much very worldly in a sense, in a way that Dostoevsky suggests might have been even a kind of off-putting to some. Books from all over and on all kinds of topics, and rather than that sort of room, we find a much more austere cell in Father Zosima, and you look at the description in the third paragraph of the chapter, and it says the cell was not very large and had a faded look. It contained nothing but the most necessary furniture of coarse and poor quality. There were two pots of flowers in the window and a number of holy pictures in the corner. Before one huge ancient icon of the Virgin, a lamp was burning. Near it were two other holy pictures in shining settings. Can you find where this is?
I don't know what chapter you're in.
Okay, chapter 2.
Of part 1?
Of part 2.
Of part 2.
I'm sorry, did I say?
I think it's
I'm lost myself. Book two, chapter two.
Yeah, hard to keep up with.
It is confusing, but boy, talk about a structured table of contents. Amazing. Part one, book two, An Unfortunate Gathering. Part chapter two, The Old Buffoon. Paragraph three.
Okay. Here we go.
And here we are. You know, Dostoevsky is not rich in his description. He is not a Balzac. He's not someone who describes every scene. But when he does, we should pay attention. And so, before one huge ancient icon of the Virgin, a lamp was burning. Near it were two other holy pictures in shining settings. And next them, carved cherubims, china eggs, a Catholic cross of ivory with a Mater Dolorosa embracing it, and several foreign engravings from the great Italian artists of past centuries. Next to these costly and artistic engravings were several of the roughest Russian prints of saints and martyrs, such as are sold for a few farthings at all the fairs. On the other walls were portraits of Russian bishops, past and present. Just a simple question. What do you think Dostoevsky means to indicate about Zosima with that description?
I thought it might have kind of been a red flag, because we know what he thinks of Roman Catholicism, but he's got an ivory, it specifically says like an ivory Catholic cross, and it's got Italian paintings, which are Western. So I didn't know if this is supposed to just...
It's sharp to pick up on that. I don't know if it necessarily, however, determines your answer. Yeah.
I wonder if he's pointing out how aesthetic Zosima is, because this is one of the things that they're always, he drives home, is that the Karamazovs are sensual people, and that Alexei is drawn to this particular figure in the monastery.
Okay, all right. So art is important, but as far as sensual, the furniture doesn't seem to, address the other senses, that would be involved in that. Yes, suggests a range, an eclecticism, but not just for enjoyment's sake.
Yeah.
But perhaps spiritual, even theological reasons. Yes. Uh-huh.
Could it be even that the things given to him by the people who come from all around, just kind of
could be. It probably was. So yeah. Yeah. Okay. Any other comments? I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Widespread, so that it seems that he's universally applicable, and he has a great appreciation for beauty, but that he still appreciates the smaller.
Good. Yeah. Well, I think so. And I think it's Italian and Russian, right? So West and East. So this is somebody who is accepting of the, and perhaps we say of the best in Christianity, whether it be Catholic or Orthodox, Roman Catholic or Orthodox. And high art and low, right? Because the high art of the Italian masters and the rough Russian prints of saints and martyrs of folk art, which is the great support of Russian religion, right? And the belief in the people that comes out of Russian Christianity is also represented there. So in a sense, we could almost read this scene allegorically, right? Because the theology the fact that the Mater Dolorosa is depicted there, the sorrowing mother of Christ, and considering the people who are going to come to him later on in this part of the novel. Yes.
By the Mater Dolorosa, do they mean a replica of the Pietà?
Not necessarily. It's a theme that can have many different representations, but it's a well-known theme. Yeah.
The sorrowing.
So I just think it's an interesting clue, and one that is more or less saying to the reader, well, here it is, judge for yourself. I was just at a interview of a candidate for president here at the university, the term transparency came up. I know that he actually did a good job of saying that wouldn't be a term that he would use. And I hate that term. It's one of our cliches now, but transparency, right? What you see is what you get, right? Father Joseph is that way, but not in the way that we would use those terms nowadays.
And I thought transparency meant you didn't see anything at all.
Didn't see anything. Invisible man. So, but he embraces the whole world. He is not a fanatic, right? And that, of course, is going to be an issue as we go on through the novel. There will be various fanaticisms that we have to look at the same time. And then we have, old Fyodor, who is up to his usual hijinks, and asks him, you know, he has a way throughout the novel, or throughout the part where he's alive, of taking a biblical verse and travestying it at some parent, you know, it's setting it in a different way. Teacher, what must I do to gain eternal life? And that comes just out of nowhere. And so we're scandalized at it. But Zosima himself is not shocked. You know, he's amused a bit. But he treats it as a serious question at the same time.
Is this in the same chapter?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is. It's just 5 pages or so. I'm sorry. I want to apologize. I didn't bring the edition that you have. I have an older one, very much marked up.
Is it?
The translation should not be too different, but the pages may be a little hard to find.
Do you have this one?
No.
No,
it's older still. But this is the paragraph about...
36,
page 36. Thank you. If somebody can, mm-hmm. when they find, sing out with the correct page number.
It's at the bottom
I would
of
be,
the first paragraph.
That would be great. I would be grateful.
You must have a different translation than me then.
And that is so. You know, Zosima responds patiently and says, "You have known for a long time what you must do. You have sense enough. Don't give way to drunkenness and incontinence of speech. Don't give way to sensual lusts, and above all, to the love of money. And close your taverns. You can't close all, at least 2 or 3. And above all, don't lie." All right, so by constantly lying, he says, the man who lies to himself and listens to his own lie comes to such a pass that he cannot distinguish the truth within him or around him, and so loses all respect for himself and for others. So the way that he approaches even someone like Fyodor is eminently practical, sees him as part of the whole human community, right, facing the same kinds of problems, just in a unique combination, perhaps, the same kinds of problems that he is so used to dealing with and that every human being has to deal with. So the elder sees right through him, in a sense, and you might even say that he's kind of fond of him, right? That he's not putting him outside the human race. So I think that all of those are certainly clues to Zosima and his approach to his calling in life. If you look in the next chapter, chapter 3, this is the one that in which he's answering a series of women who come to him. And that first one begins, "But here is one from afar." Right? So that's 3 pages or so into the into chapter 3. Can you find where that is?
Page 40.
Page 40, thank you. "But here is one from afar." Right? And it says that, and she starts off in a almost ritual sing-song voice. It says, "From afar off, Father, from afar off, from 200 miles from here, from afar off, Father, from afar off." And Dostoevsky comments movingly in the next paragraph, "There is silent and long-suffering sorrow to be met with among the peasantry. It withdraws into itself and is still, but there is a grief that breaks out, and from that minute it bursts into tears and finds vent in wailing. This is particularly common with women, but it's no lighter a grief than the silent. Lamentations comfort only by lacerating the heart still more." Lacerations, another theme that runs through the novel. "Such grief does not desire consolation. It feeds on the sense of its hopelessness. Lamentations spring only from the constant craving to reopen the wound." And we would say, in our modern world, that this is dysfunctional, you know. But it's something that has a profundity for Dostoevsky's view here, and it's something that Father Zosima deals with sympathy. I've buried my son, buried my little son, and I've come on a pilgrimage, she says. It's my little son I'm grieving for, Father. He's 3 years old, 3 years old, but 3 months. For my little boy, Father, I'm in anguish for my little boy. He was the last one left. We had four, my Nikita and I, and now we've no children. Our dear ones have all gone. I buried the first three without grieving over much, and now I've buried the last. I can't forget him. He seems always standing before me. It's a heartbreaking narrative that she gives, and she ends by confessing that she just can't live with her husband anymore. What would our life be now together? I'm done with him. I've done with them all. I don't care to look upon my house and my goods. I don't care to see anything at all. And Zosima tries to soften her and console her, and says at the end of that first paragraph of his answer, therefore you too, mother, know that your little one is surely before the throne of God, is rejoicing and happy and praying to God for you, and therefore weep, but rejoice. Now, this is kind of a standard answer, and this attempt to comfort her fails, right? My Nikita tried to comfort me with the same words as you, she said. So they're both, she's being very honest to him, right? Foolish one, he said, why weep? Our son is no doubt singing with the angels before God. He says that to me, but he weeps himself, and so forth. And it goes on. Zosima has to recalibrate, he has to reconsider. He says, it is Rachel of old, said the elder, weeping for her children and will not be comforted because they are not. Such is the lot set on earth for you mothers. Be not comforted. So he changes as he hears her and hears the depth of her grief. Be not comforted. Consolation is not what you need. Weep and be not consoled. Why? Because this is a reality, right? Because this is her. This is and also we hear something here about the value of suffering for Zosima. Weep and be not consoled, but weep. Only every time that you weep, be sure to remember that your little son is one of the angels of God, that he looks down from there at you and sees you and rejoices at your tears and points at them to the Lord God. And a long while yet you will keep that great mother's grief, but it will turn in the end into quiet joy. Bitter tears will be only tears of tender sorrow that purifies the heart and delivers it from sin. Right, and the child's name is Alexei. And he does say at the end of this comment to her, he said, go back to your husband. It's a sin to leave him. Right. So this is an unsentimental treatment of this great grief that she has, and one that he has had trouble finding a way to answer her, to help her, but that he has to end by saying, I acknowledge that grief is a reality, and you must have it. That quiet joy will come later. But he's a straight shooter. He tells people what they must do, even if they're into something bad. And then we have, as if to make that point, one in which he realizes that the woman has killed her husband, her abusive husband. And this is a couple of pages later, and he suddenly says, stay, right, and tells her not to talk anymore, right? And he puts his ear close to her so that she can whisper. So this becomes almost like a real confession. Right? She says, 3 years ago? She says, 3 years. At first I didn't think about it, but now I've begun to be ill, and the thought never leaves me. So forth. Have you told it in confession? I've confessed it twice. I've confessed it. Have you been admitted to communion? Yes, I'm afraid. I'm afraid to die. Fear nothing and never be afraid. And don't fret. If only your penitence fail not, God will forgive all. There is no sin, and there can be no sin on all the earth which the Lord will not forgive to the truly repentant. Man cannot commit a sin so great as to exhaust the infinite love of God. I think it's so important to hear these things, again, after you've gone through, and again, I hate to tweak some of you, but after you've gotten through the Grand Inquisitor, because it all takes on a dialogical and dialectical meaning. It's also, in its own right, wonderful, you know, wonderful to read in its own way. Think only of repentance, continual repentance, but dismiss fear altogether. Believe that God loves you as you cannot conceive, that he loves you with your sin, in your sin. And if his encounter with old Fyodor didn't make that point, this does, right? It has been said of old that over one repentant sinner there is more joy in heaven than over 10 righteous men. But then he says, forgive the dead man in your heart what wrong he did you. So she's killed him. He was terrible. He was abusive to her, put her through hell. She killed him. She feels terrible about what she's done. She's confessed it. He's said, you know, move on, you know. But still, he senses she hasn't forgiven the man he's killed. She's killed. So just think about that next time you think about such things. It's still not going to help you to forgive the person if you kill him. Be reconciled with him in truth. That's the real work of spirit, the labor of soul that she's got to go through. Love is such a priceless treasure, he says, that you can redeem the whole world by it and expiate not only your own sins, but the sins of others. So we're moving on toward that great theme in the next chapter of love. What is love? What is active love? But we get one more, and this also would be a great example of the woman who comes, very, very poor, but has her 60 kopecks, right, to give to him because he would know best who to give it to. Wonderful example of active love. And a refutation in advance of the vision of Ivan Karamazov, without, you know, without saying this, without stressing it, but for Ivan, the human race is poor and incapable. The human race is largely made up of victims who are unable to care for themselves, have been, if injustice has met them, there is no way that they can deal with it. And they are so weak and so fallible that they need to be taken care of. And here is someone in her poverty, right, gives him money to give to others. So the resilience and strength of people is something that Zosima knows that Dostoevsky is trying to show us, I think, through this this presentation. So it's a rich encounter here with these different women. Each of them an example is, I think, extremely well chosen. And then comes the one with Madame Holokov, right? And this is the chapter titled A Lady of Little Faith. And it's titled that because she says that, you know, help me, Father, I have little faith. My faith is weak. And this is Lisa's mother. And we know that she says, I can't help but think about the afterlife. And I think this is, I've got a note here that says this is page 47. See if that's right. As he says, I quite believe in the sincerity of your suffering. And she says, oh, how thankful I am to you. See, I shut my eyes and ask myself, if everyone has faith, where did it come from? Do you see that paragraph? Is that page 47?
Yeah.
Okay. And then she says, what if I believe? I say to myself, what if I've been believing all my life, and when I come to die, there's nothing but the burdocks growing on my grave, as I read in some author. Now, do you all know what author that was? Oh, is it? Oh, that's no fun. I wanted you to gloat along with me. It's one of those sliding references to Turgenev that Dostoevsky likes to make. Nothing but the burdocks growing on my grave. Right? So.
How far down is that from where she starts? From where she says, I suffer from little faith?
It's
about more.
And on the next page, then there's that question of, well, she says, how can I prove it? And he says, there's no proving it. though you can be convinced of it. And this is the question. She says, how? And this is the, what's the question? The question is there really life after death? Is there really those promises that our faith has made real? Right? And there's no proving it, but you can know it. You can be convinced of it. He says, by the experience of active love, strive to love your neighbor actively and indefatigably. Inasfar as you advance in love, you will grow surer of the reality of God and of the immortality of your soul. If you attain to perfect self-forgetfulness in the love of your neighbor, then you will believe without doubt, and no doubt can possibly enter your soul. This has been tried. This is certain. So he speaks almost with the rhetoric of a Zen master. You know, I mean, there is that sense that instead of it being a quest for, you know, ultimate spirituality, it's for active love. It's for work in this world. It's incarnation. And yet he approaches it as though it has the same kind of steps of discipline as being apprenticed to a great mystical master, a great master in some mystical tradition. Interesting contrast then comes in the very next paragraph. All this very instructive, this paving the path that we're going to be treading all throughout this novel. Active love versus love in dreams, right? Because Madame Holakoff is so marvelously frank with what she says about herself. One of her redeeming qualities, certainly, is that she's frank about herself, right? In active love, she says, and there's another question. You see, I so love humanity that, would you believe it, I often dream of forsaking all that I have, leaving Lisa, and becoming a Sister of Mercy. I close my eyes and think and dream, and at that moment I feel full of strength to overcome all obstacles, and so forth. I would nurse the afflicted. I would be ready to kiss such wounds, and so forth. And he says, and listen to this, it is much and well that your mind is full of such dreams and not others. Sometime, unawares, you may do a good deed in reality. So we have that contrast being set up early on in the book between reality and dream, right? Between active love and the easy kind of love that is love in dreams, that is, of course, ultimately narcissistic in some way. It's very, very fulfilling for yourself. But perfect self-forgetfulness, he says, leads to absolute certainty of the truth of God's promises. So, love is not a feeling. This book is in some way a kind of long assault on most of the doctrines of Romanticism, or at least as Dostoevsky characterizes Romanticism. You must approach love as you would a branch of learning. It has to be conscious, and it takes labor and fortitude. Right? And he goes on to talk about that in a couple of pages. After that, it goes on, that whole paragraph that begins, are you speaking the truth? Well, now, after such a confession, I believe that you are sincere and good at heart. Above all, avoid falsehood. Avoid being scornful. Avoid fear. These are things he's already said to others. Don't be frightened over much, even at your evil actions. So this is a kind of summation of the other people that he's seen. I'm sorry I can say nothing more consoling to you, for love in action is a harsh and dreadful thing compared with love in dreams. Love in dreams is greedy for immediate action, rapidly performed, and in the sight of all. Men will even give their lives if only the ordeal does not last long, but is soon over, with all looking on. But active love is labor and fortitude, and for some people too, perhaps a complete science. So this is his notion. And I predict, he says, just when you see with horror that in spite of all your efforts, you're getting further from your goal, at that very moment I predict that you will reach it and behold clearly the miraculous power of the Lord, who has been all the time loving and mysteriously guiding you. So again, that again faintly that strikes the notion of unless a grain of wheat fall to the earth and die, it shall not bear fruit. It's that hopelessness, moment of hopelessness, that is right before the greatest fulfillment. Okay, so that's our introduction to Zosima, and we get a good deal more of him later on. Now then we must be introduced to Ivan a little better, right? And we have, of course, his article in which he claims that the whole state should become a church, and we're surprised by this. What is this? I thought you were an unbeliever. I thought you were a secularist. Why are you doing being such a advocate of the church, right? And but we see, if we don't see it immediately, we see it gradually, that he's talking about this in a way that in which the definition of church is quite fungible, and it becomes a social church, right? And in this sense, we see Dostoevsky as a prophet of an aspect of what's happening in our day. The state is coming to take on more and more authority in our lives. There's been a term I've seen taken from Tocqueville that resonates with this, and that is soft despotism, right? That we do it to ourselves, but the state enters more and more into the regulation of our behavior, of the behavior of institutions like the family and churches that used to themselves be moral arbiters of morality. So that's something that Dostoevsky saw coming, and not by, I should hasten to add, not by some mystical power that Dostoevsky had, but simply by analyzing, by looking and carefully studying the world around him and the trends of thought from the Enlightenment on. Recall that this is 1880. The 20th century was as yet undawned, right? The era of dictatorship. That we can, no matter how far we go into the future, the 20th century will always be known as the era of in which thought control was discovered and total ideology as a way of life for a dictator and his people. So all of this, something predicted in principle, in its outlines, in its principles, by Dostoevsky, not in detail, but because he's got his finger more confidently on the pulse of these principles, it is a great tonic to read him, to see what it is that we have ourselves bought into without knowing. All right. So, if what Ivan says, though, about the state and the church had come about, and the state and the church had unified, with this, what one monk calls ultramontanism, right? Then, when the woman had come to Father Zosima and had confessed her killing her husband, he would have had to turn her in.
Right? No, because the laws of the confessional bar you from saying.
But it's not a confession.
This is not a sacrament that he's administering. This is spiritual advice. This is the tradition of the elders. And he asked her, "Have you confessed this?" She said, "Yeah." So that's something else. But I'm just saying, hypothetically, if the church were the state and the state were the church, do you see?
Oh, I see. Hypothetically.
Yeah. If, and that's an if that Ivan would feel comfortable with. So he claims. So this is something we want to keep in mind. So you must remember, when you're reading the Grand Inquisitor section, if you haven't read it already, that this is, as Ivan says, this is his poem, and not then Dostoevsky's poem, but something within Dostoevsky's grand design. This document, poem, whatever we want to call it, this story, tells us more about Ivan and the terrible mental anguish, the intellectual conflict going on in his mind, than it does about Dostoevsky's own beliefs, which it doesn't tell us about. So, and I think we want to talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But I wanted to get that in case we don't get to it later on today. So now, So what is it, then, that causes this excruciating anguish in Ivan and in Dmitri, in so many of the characters that we see in this novel? We see this as a human question, not as a question just to solve questions about a particular set of characters, but what is it that makes us go through so much suffering? What makes us feel that we are in the right and the world is wrong? And I think that Dostoevsky shows us in this early part of the novel that it's our yearning for justice. And that's certainly the keynote that we strike over and over in encountering Ivan, yearning for justice. But all the Karamazov brothers are in search of justice. And Ivan, of course, says, I must have justice or I will destroy myself.
What section is that in?
That's the one you haven't read yet.
The Grand Inquisitor.
It's the lead up to the Grand Inquisitor. Right, I must have justice or I will destroy myself. And so it doesn't seem like a happy outcome is in the cards for Ivan. But Dmitri wants justice, demands justice, right? And he thinks it's simply a matter of the most material and straightforward matter. He wants his inheritance. Right? Alyosha even demands justice in his own way of God. So all of that, and we have to think then of our, you know, of the resources that literature gives us for thinking about this question. Think of the book of Job, right? And of Job's anguish as he calls to God and asks for how I can be just. And God's response has nothing to do with justice. It has to do with love, ultimately. It has to do with his creation. Right? But we think some of our great tragic heroes who are tormented by that question of justice, King Lear, right? Captain Ahab, what could be more unjust than for me to have lost that leg? Iago, right? It's not just that I was treated so. I'm very little stressed, but we see that that's, if we find a motive for Iago, it is that slighted by Othello. And it's wrong, it's unjust. Ultimately, this points to someone we've mentioned earlier in the course, Satan, Milton Satan, right? And his that famous phrase from Paradise Lost, from sense of injured merit. From sense of injured merit, you know, that involves pride into the question of justice, but still, that's the profile that the quest for justice ultimately moves toward. So, we all long for justice. But these brothers, as this is going to be connected with the fact that each of them, in their way, all have to fall to the earth and die, right, before they bear fruit. If they bear fruit. If they are to bear fruit. Right. It's that longing that leads them in that direction. And I think in that dimension, just that I too am a Karamazov theme, he's talking about all of Russia, and ultimately the whole human race with this struggle. The part that is most overtly concerned with justice is the legend of the Grand Inquisitor. And now you must know that sometimes in anthologies, in various kinds of intellectual treatments, this work, the story of the Grand Inquisitor, has been just lifted out of the novel and treated as a work of art in itself. And I think to do that is a grave error and really an injustice to Dostoevsky, because it's a poem within a poem, right? But in a strange new way that Dostoevsky has followed the logic of that idea and said that it must be a kind of double deformation, that it's a fiction that reveals us all of Ivan's world, just as that Dostoevsky's work as a whole reveals to us Dostoevsky's world. But we have to, and that reason, we have to assess it and judge it as such. And we see Alyosha struggling to do that, right? Struggling to ask, but what can this mean? What's the meaning of this? Is this a simple pro quo, he says, a simple mix-up? How can this make any sense? That's absurd. Not even Rome is this way, he goes on, right? All these various responses of Alyosha. But he doesn't have a coherent response to the story. It's a well-thought-out story, and we see, as Ivan has said, it's one that he's said to himself over and over. He's never written it out. It's a new medium, not the oral tradition exactly, but the mental tradition. He's thought this out, and it is something that, as Dostoevsky crafts it, it has its own kind of, I don't know, what would you call the tone of this of the work? There's a kind of terrifying stateliness to it all. I don't know if that's right.
It's certainly possibly the most misread section of anything Dostoevsky ever wrote.
I think it is, and part of it is the tone, because it reads like such an important work. It's an attempt at the high style by a novelist who does not write in such a style. No novelist really writes in this style. And an attempt to paint according to the colors of the palette of the sublime, you know, rather than the straightforward.
It's the ultimate example of the polyphonic.
Boy, is it. Yeah, absolutely. So this gives us a complete world from one point of view. That is not the author's own. And also, we're faced also with that old technical problem of the reliable or unreliable narrator, right? So there's that as well. Although that, I'm not sure that gets at it quite as effectively as kind of a more general look at this as poetry. But this, you know, this moment, and the moment leading up to it, in which Ivan and Alyosha talk, right, is the pivotal confrontation of the whole book.
You know, I interject something here,
sure,
in my mind, real quickly. The horrors that Ivan recounts are mostly taken from newspapers. You ever watch the local evening news? I can't watch it anymore. It's just all about terrible things that are happening all around you. And so if one of the things that you see in the whole section of the Grand Inquisitor is the impact of another way of telling a story in modern journalism.
Hmm. Hmm.
And so
yes.
There's a polyphony within this.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting, yeah. They are. They all read like newspaper stories.
And of course, Dostoevsky got a lot of information from newspapers, too, a lot of ideas.
There is a kind of a prefab sense to each one of these terrible stories, right? Mm-hmm. And one of them, in fact, is a reenactment of Raskolnikov's dream in The Crime and Punishment, mm-hmm. right, about the peasant who whips the horse, the poor aged mare, across the eyes and so forth. All of that is not even a story told by Dostoevsky. It's a dream that one of his earlier characters had. So there is a certain kind of, you know, it's a very interesting phenomenon, the way that I think Dostoevsky went to lengths to get that sense of manufacturedness. Not that such horrors don't happen, mm-hmm. right? Don't mistake me. But we're looking for the tone.
In the chapter Rebellion or the Grand Inquisitor?
We're in the Grand Inquisitor now. Yeah.
Don't
so there's going to be
some
spoilers here.
Each of those instances has been ripped from a context.
Yes. Right.
So in isolation, they're certainly horrible.
And that Ivan is keeping a kind of chapbook of all of these kinds of episodes, mm-hmm. apparently to indict humanity with, but without keeping track of what is the context, what might lead to such events or allow us to prevent them or anything like that. Right? It's not that, but it's a matter, it's like a prosecuting attorney having found a list of misdeeds, and for that reason, as he says, well, but I mean, these things are serious questions. Dostoevsky himself is certainly struggling with and saying that we struggle with. Yes, Patrick.
Could you say that maybe this is one of the early examples of mass media having producing kind of a skewed effect in people's minds?
I think it's a brilliant idea. I just hadn't thought of that before. I think that's an excellent idea.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think of the impact of newspapers. In the 19th century is the first time when newspapers emerge as a voice, a silent, you know, a printed voice for daily events and all of this. The railroad has brought people closer together in ways that aren't always salutary. And the same thing has happened with news. This is when news begins. Before that, news took weeks and weeks and weeks. When the at the charge of the Light Brigade was the first time that people got instant news. You know what that meant? It meant 2 weeks after it happened.
Yeah, Patrick.
And that changed things.
How would you characterize the difference between the effect of like the newspaper, that kind of mass media, with Turgenev's sketches from A Hunter's Notebook, and the kind of social effect that that had in terms of playing into the freedom of the serfs?
Well, that's a different, but you see, that's the difference. It's a cumulative effect that comes out of a direct experience. Whereas in the newspaper, what you get is the event itself, perhaps a motive, but you don't have a moral context for any of this. You don't have much of a historical context for it. So if we find out that somebody has abducted a child, we get excited and we fear for ourselves, but we don't necessarily find out why this happened. We just know that it happened.
Okay.
Is part of the danger that you're actually separated from the action? Like, you don't have any personal connection to this injustice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you see that the contrast with Alyosha tracing down why that little boy bit
yes.
his finger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
then it's not just a event that's happened
that's
to somebody else.
That's a very yeah. interesting contrast because he finds out where he himself his innocence involved. His
yeah.
his family is involved in what the child
mm-hmm.
has done. Yeah, that's very, very interesting. Yeah. Okay. I know there are a lot of interesting questions that come on this, but let me just say, and because, you know, This is a position that I do inherit. I think the great enunciator, at least on this campus, and you know, for the most part, in Dostoevsky criticism, whether known or not, has been Lewis Cowan. That this is not a true statement from the heart of Dostoevsky's core beliefs, but it is rather a misleading indication of Ivan's inner conflict. His world. There has been at least one essay on record before her that makes this point, and that is by the great theologian Romano Guardini, who wrote this back in the 1940s, but it was not a terribly well-known essay. We dug and dug to find it.
Yeah, it's still not easy to find.
No. But let me just say, on the other side of that, why then does Dostoevsky do this? Just to tell us about a character? No, far from it. He's telling us about a whole point of view that the Western world has convinced itself of. It gives us a weak and ineffectual and aesthetically beautiful Christ, an admirable Christ in the abstract, right, who doesn't speak, but only performs in beautiful actions. All the palette, I'm suggesting, in a term, using the metaphor of palette. All the palette here is either the beautiful or the sublime. And this is what Europe and the West has talked itself into as the legacy and meaning of Christianity. So in presenting this, and in presenting this, though, as is very typical of Dostoevsky from a positive point of view, from a spokesperson's point of view, he's showing as strong as he can a critique of what has become of the West's understanding of Christianity.
Kind of talking about Dostoevsky's relation to Ivan's point of view, is there that same distance between him and Alyosha's viewpoints, or are they closer?
Yeah, I think they're closer.
But you will notice that for all of that, there's still that balance that we get in a realistic novel, which explains things not by imposing some sort of system or
yes.
point of view on
uh-huh.
them. Still, Alyosha has to earn the right to think where he, the way he does in action in the novel. So it's not as though he is personally sanctioned by the author.
Now, not only is this telling us a critique of, you know, of modern Christianity, but it is, in fact, asking some heart-wrenchingly difficult and necessary questions. Right? This crisis of faith of Ivan is a very genuine one, because he is basically asking, can Christianity do anything in this world in the face of these terrible injustices? Does it offer only the next world? Does it offer what he calls a higher harmony, which he rejects? He rejects because it would have to include the torturer along with the tortured. Right? Is heaven built on the tears of infants? And we have to, you know, to, this is necessary to struggle with these questions. Is the Christian impotent in the face of evil? All of these are the troubling questions that have led him to his resolution in this fiction that he's created. And he says, you'll recall in this memorable moment about, I believe in God, right? But I respectfully return the ticket. That phrase, which means I don't accept his creation. I don't accept the terms of his creation, not just of salvation, but his creation. And so Alyosha responds to that, well, you don't believe in God. But Ivan doesn't agree to that, and on the story goes on in that way. But that confrontation between the two is the pivotal encounter in this book. And we find ourselves, I think, implicit in both characters. And that moment in which they look into each other's eyes and their whole soul is included in that look could be seen as one of Dostoevsky's iconic moments. Right? It's, because behind each of them is an old man. Right? Behind Ivan is the Grand Inquisitor himself, who is, as far as Ivan considers it, wise and powerful and suffering. And behind Alyosha is his spiritual master, Zosima. So very different. One is fictional, one is real. But this confrontation wraps up Ivan with his thirst for justice, his tender heart, his tortured mind, his misunderstanding of love. Very crucial for this entire novel. And his hope still to save mankind somehow. And it pits against him Alyosha with his naivete, his innocence, his untested spirituality, and yet his very real love. So the meeting ends, the encounter ends with a kiss, because he doesn't know what else to say. And Ivan says, that's plagiarism. So, okay, well, we'll talk more about the Grand Inquisitor next time, and we'll go on from there. We want to get on through of the great Zosima section, and remember, as I said, read through the end of Book 9 for next Tuesday. For next Thursday, please try to have read through the Grand Inquisitor, if you haven't already.
Yeah, basically, Bond doesn't approve of evil.
Yeah.
That's what he wants to.
And I don't either.
Yeah. I'm with it there.
Are we meant to see a connection, though, between the silent kiss and also Father Zosima's silent bow to Dmitri?
Oh, I don't know.
Perhaps. The kiss may mean that Alyosha senses Ivan's suffering, which is not the abstract suffering.
Uh-huh.
about the horror of evil, but that he's in a real crisis himself, a psychological and mental crisis. Oh, pretty good.
Can I give this? This is kind of my thesis, an abstract for a research paper, so I thought I'd give it to you in advance. You can look over it.
Yeah, I wish.
Uh-huh.